May it please the Court. In this case, counsel representing a client facing a potential death sentence failed to call a critical exculpatory witness. That eyewitness, Anthony Villanueva, would have testified that he did not recognize Mr. Malone from the scene. That failure was inexcusable and professionally unreasonable. The Constitution entitles all criminal defendants to representation and requires that counsel perform in accordance with objectively reasonable standards of competence. Counsel's failure was objectively unreasonable and prejudiced Mr. Malone in violation of Strickland. As this Court, I'm sure, is aware, Strickland requires a showing of both prejudice and counsel's ineffectiveness. Prejudice has resulted when there is a reasonable probability that but for counsel's unprofessional errors, the result of the proceeding would have been different. Not whether it was more likely than not that the result would have been different, not whether there is conclusive proof of innocence, but that there is a reasonable probability that the errors could have tipped the calculus of reasonable doubt in Mr. Malone's favor. In this respect, the Illinois Appellate Court applied the wrong prejudice standard. It found that Mr. Malone did not establish that the outcome would have been different. They should have asked whether there was a reasonable probability that the outcome would have been different, or in the words of this Court, whether he had a good shot of acquittal.
Didn't it correctly phrase the standard several times in its opinion?
It correctly stated the standard earlier in the opinion, but in the paragraphs where it was analyzing whether there was prejudice, it...
You know, one has to distinguish between shorthand and a mistake. You may know about 3 years ago, the Ninth Circuit got reversed summarily for saying a misstatement in an opinion that stated the standard correctly twice leads to a federal writ.
Yes. Well, to...
We don't want to go the same way.
Certainly.
Right? The Supreme Court has said if you misstate a standard after you've already demonstrated that you understand what it is, that's not a basis for relief. I think we just need to go forward from there.
2 points. It appears that the analysis was that they were implying it incorrectly, but as this Court held in Stanley, although the Court can grant the Illinois Appellate Court the benefit of the doubt that they were applying the correct standard, it still can be an unreasonable application of that standard, and we think that is what's happened here.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about why is this an unreasonable application of the correct standard?
In this case, there were two eyewitnesses that testified against Mr. Malone, one who testified that he was the shooter and one who merely was able to put him at the scene. And Anthony Villanueva would have testified that he saw the shooting and he did not recognize Mr. Malone from the scene. That when asked in open court whether he recognized any of the six individuals he saw that morning, Anthony Villanueva was only able to identify Defendant Davis. That, under the precedence of this Court, should constitute an unreasonable application. In Hampton, when faced with far greater eyewitness testimony against the defendant, the failure to call an eyewitness suggesting that the defendant was not there was an unreasonable application. This Court's decision in Goodman also found...
So your view is this case basically comes down to a question of eyewitness identification when all said and done.
Yes, and the state court also held that essentially...
And one of the eyewitnesses here didn't testify.
Yes.
And that his testimony, in fact, may have been just enough to give the jury the doubt that apparently the judge had.
Yes, and you pointed out the judge's decision with regard to the co-defendants. One needs look no further than the acquittals of Taylor and Davis, the co-defendants, to see that this eyewitness could have affected the calculus of reasonable doubt.
Because the judge apparently believed Villanueva and didn't believe Stewart.
It seems essential to the judge's opinion that he must have disregarded Stewart's testimony and favored Villanueva's credibility. I feel it's important to point out the state in its briefs makes an attempt to attack the credibility of Villanueva's testimony by stating that he may not have actually seen the shooting and that there was a question about the number of shots fired. And we believe that the state misstated the record in this case. He was clearly asked whether he saw the shooting. He said that he saw six individuals. He said that he saw the four individuals that he knew. He saw them for long enough to recognize that he knew them, and two individuals that he did not know. He clearly stated that he saw them for 2 to 3 minutes, and that when asked who he could recognize in the courtroom, he only pointed to Defendant Davis. And that's when Defendant Davis is sitting at the same defense table next to my client, Mr. Malone. Furthermore, the state's attempt to discredit Villanueva's testimony is contrary to the Illinois Appellate Court opinion in this case. The Illinois Appellate Court analyzed the doubt caused by Villanueva's testimony, but did not question that he saw the shooting, that he saw certain individuals there, and that he could not recognize Mr. Malone.
What are we going to do with that Illinois Appellate Court, though? I mean, the standard is here whether they were reasonable, and they at least did address this issue. I mean, pretty vague, elliptical terms, but they did address the issue. How do we deal with that?
They addressed the issue, but I believe it was an unreasonable application of Strickland not to find that that eyewitness's testimony could have caused a reasonable probability to contradict the other two eyewitnesses. The Illinois Appellate Court notes that Villanueva's testimony casts doubt on whether Mr. Malone is at the scene. They also note that Officer Williams, had he been called, he would have cast doubts on Stewart's credibility. And it's also important to know that Villanueva directly contradicts Stewart to some extent, and that would have undermined Stewart's credibility and possibly created reasonable doubt in the mind of the jury. Under the second prong of Strickland, Mr. Malone must prove ineffectiveness. And this court has held time and again that empty assertions of trial strategy are not entitled to the benefit of the doubt.
And all the defense counsel said was trial strategy?
He didn't
give any further explanation.
He, at the sentencing hearing, he brought up Villanueva's testimony by introducing Detective Markham. He stated that this testimony showed it was unclear what actually happened that night. And then the judge at trial said, well, if this was relevant, then why wasn't it brought up at before the jury? And he merely stated as a matter of trial strategy, without any substantive explanation of what that strategy was. I believe I've covered my chief points. I think it's essential to look at the effect of the excluded testimony on the two co-defendants, and that calculus would have changed the prejudice determination the court applied the correct Strickland standard. I would conclude by noting that Mr. Malone has served a 20-year life sentence of a conviction that never should have been. It's inconceivable that counsel would not call an exculpatory witness when his client faced a possible death sentence. In that regard, his performance fell well below standards of reasonable competence. He was denied his constitutional right to reasonably competent counsel, and as a result, we respectfully assert that he is now entitled to habeas relief.
Before you sit down, you might want to address the state's argument that this claim has not been preserved in state court.
We believe that the state's argument that this claim has not been preserved in state court is...
The state relies principally on Lewis against Stearns, which I noticed your brief didn't discuss.
We believe that Lewis v. Stearns is inapplicable.
Well, yeah, but the usual way you do that is to discuss it in the brief rather than ignore the state's principal argument and raise the issue for the first time when prodded by a judge.
Well, we believe the more applicable case was the Sweeney versus Carter case, which addressed the on-point factual case. In Lewis, the court found that the ineffectiveness of counsel was not raised at all level of state court because the underlying reason that counsel was ineffective was not raised at each state. On appeal,
That's not how I understand Lewis. Lewis says that if you argue in state court that appellate counsel was ineffective, but do not challenge the behavior of trial counsel, you have not preserved a claim that trial counsel was ineffective. Now, that's the principal argument that the state is making.
That is the argument that the state is making, but I believe Lewis says that at the federal level, it was the first time that petitioner had alleged an independent Batson violation, and that was why it was procedurally defaulted.
He was pro se at that point, wasn't he?
Excuse me?
I'm sorry. He was pro se at that point.
He was represented by appointed counsel. I'm sorry, Lewis or Mr. Malone?
Malone.
He was represented by appointed counsel at the post-conviction proceeding and at the post-conviction appeal.
But wasn't there a point where he was pro se?
Yes, he filed his habeas petition
right.
pro se.
Well, do we hold, all right, never mind, I'll.
On the facts of this case also, I think it's important to note that there was no stage in the state court where the state court didn't acknowledge trial counsel's ineffectiveness for failing to call Villanueva. It was argued, it was mentioned in all of the state court's briefs and state court opinions and analyzed. The state's own briefs addressed the issue, and Mr. Malone brought it up in each and every petition. So I believe it's fairly presented under this court's precedent, Sweeney versus Carter. Thank you.
Mr. Blankenheim.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel, and may it please the Court. My name is Michael Blankenheim. I'm an Assistant Attorney General appearing this morning on behalf of the respondent, appellee Kevin Gilson. The District Court's judgment denying habeas relief should be affirmed because petitioners claim that trial counsel was ineffective for failing to call.
Let's go directly to the subject we were just covering, which is the effect of Lewis. I have some difficulty seeing why Lewis would apply to a situation in which, even though the argument was not properly presented in state court, the state appellate court, in fact, considered the merits. And my reading of the state's appellate decision is that they actually addressed, for two pages, the question whether trial counsel was ineffective. And normally we say, I think, that an issue is preserved for federal review if it's actually decided by the state court, even if you haven't done the right things. Isn't that the governing principle?
Yes, but in this case...
Then why would Lewis matter, right?
Lewis matters...
Looks like Malone skipped an argument, did not make the right arguments, but the state court gave him the benefit of the doubt and considered the arguments as if they had been made correctly. State court having actually resolved the merits, one can move to federal court. Isn't that fairly straightforward?
If the claim is not fairly presented to the state courts, then the claim is subject.
No, I'm interested in the set of cases where the claim is not properly presented to the state court and where the state court could therefore have invoked a rule of forfeiture, but the state court decides it on the merits anyway. Right? Has that claim been preserved or not? I read Harris to say that, yes, it's been preserved if it's actually decided on the merits without invoking a rule of forfeiture.
That's correct. In this case, the state appellate court noted that petitioner's...
But it was actually decided on the merits.
Part of the petitioner's Strickland claim was decided on the merits.
Look, the Illinois state courts had a meaningful opportunity to pass upon the substance of the claims of ineffective assistance of trial counsel. Those courts expended much ink on the issue of whether trial counsel was ineffective for failing to call Villanueva. And, you know, as I noted a bit earlier, at one point, Mr. Malone was pro se. So
he was pro se in the trial court, Your Honor, but not on post-conviction appeal. He was represented by an attorney. But turning to the merits of this case, because of the state appellate court's rejection of the Strickland claim on the prejudice prong was at least minimally consistent with the facts and circumstances of the case, the district court correctly denied habeas relief. A petitioner contends that the key to the acquittal of co-defendants Davis and Taylor was Anthony Villanueva's testimony. That's not correct. In petitioner's trial, two witnesses testified that petitioner was at the scene.
But look, forgive me for interrupting. But don't we need some articulation of what the trial counsel's strategy is? Oh, no.
May I have your attention, please? A fire has been reported in another area of the building. You are in a safe area.
Most likely a short circuit.
Should I continue or just...
How many of you really believe that on the 27th floor you are
all right.
a safe area?
All right, Mr. Blankenham, your time has expired.
Look.
No, just everybody yeah. treat this as your work area and stay here.
Don't, except for
There's
me.
There's no accounting
I'm leaving.
For the, no accounting for the General Services Administration.
Judge Rowe, were you
yeah,
finished?
Yeah, I mean, don't we need some articulation of what the trial attorney's strategy actually was before we can credit a lawyer's explanation that his failure to, you know, his failure to call a possibly exculpatory witness was actually a strategy? What strategy? What's the strategy?
The strategy is that counsel had doubts about Villanueva's testimony, and the record of the...
But he never says that.
But the record of the state court proceeding supports that. We know from petition...
No, but he never says, this is my trial strategy.
Well, again, that's correct. He just says that he has a strategic reason.
Okay, so, and then we are supposed to put ideas into this fellow's mouth?
Let me ask Judge Rovner's question in a different way. Was there any danger in putting Villanueva on the stand in Malone's case?
Absolutely there was. And the state had introduced two witnesses who identified petitioner. One witness identified him as the murderer. The other placed him at the scene before and after the crime. Now, if the defense counsel's only response to that in the form of affirmative testimony is the testimony of Villanueva, which is ambiguous, and as the state appellate court noted, Villanueva never testified that petitioner was not present at the scene of the crime. So if the only witness that trial counsel calls can't even clearly exculpate petitioner, his case is sunk in the eyes of the jury.
Was there any danger? The question I'm asking is, was there a... You know, if I were defense counsel, I would worry about putting Villanueva on, asking him point blank, did you see my client? Because if I don't ask him that... the state will, and Villanueva will then say, well, come to think of it, yes, I did.
Certainly. And that
would be the worst possible turn of events.
Certainly.
Do we know, for example, whether counsel had interviewed Villanueva and thought there was a risk of this?
We know from petitioner's post-conviction petition, this is at the post-conviction common law record at pages 22 and 23, petitioner claims that his lawyer interviewed Villanueva before trial, allegedly told Mr. Malone that he would call Villanueva, but ultimately decided not to call him. And I think that if we look at Villanueva's testimony in the trial of co-defendant Davis, we see what the problem with that testimony is. Villanueva is all over the place in terms of what he saw during the shooting. He was asked several times by the prosecutor whether he had seen the shooting, and several times he responded that he hadn't, that bricks were in the way, that the shooters were too far away from his vantage point. In addition, he testified that he didn't know Malone, that he had never seen Malone, that he would not know Malone if he saw him.
Yeah, well, now it sounds like you're making the other side's point.
Well, this court in Hampton has noted that witness testimony from individuals who aren't acquainted with the defendant has less probative value than when, as in this case, witnesses such as Stewart and Tate had seen petitioner before, and that kind of identification testimony is stronger. All right, if there are no further questions, Your Honors, I'd ask the court to affirm the district court's judgment. I thank the court for its time this morning.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Nelson, we'll give you one extra minute for a rebuttal.
I had two quick points. First, I wanted to clarify the conversation I had, the argument I made earlier about the Illinois Appellate Court standard applying the reasonable probability standard. We believe it misstated the standard, but it's irrelevant because it misapplied the standard by saying that it cast doubt, it established that there was reasonable probability. Casting doubt is the equivalent of saying that it could have changed the jury's mind, or at least there was a reasonable probability. Secondly, the state is speculating on the reasons for counsel's failure to question Villanueva. It is not in the record why counsel chose not to call or ask Villanueva any further questions. And even if all that was before the jury was Villanueva saying, of the six people I saw that morning, I only saw her, Defendant Davis, that itself would have been exculpatory. It does not in any way hurt Mr. Malone's case to have a witness say that he saw the scene and he did not recognize Mr. Malone from the scene. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.